From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Iraqi Prime Minister Iyad Alawi says the citizens of Fallujah have been taken hostage and must be freed. The U.S. general in charge says his soldiers are ready to do the job within a few days. The Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, says the battle in Fallujah is critical to the creation of a free Iraq because, quote, one part of the country cannot remain under the rule of assassins. 10 to 15,000 U.S. and Iraqi troops have sealed off the Sunni Triangle city and have been moving in street by street, block by block throughout the day today. Depending on which estimate you believe, there are between 1 and 4,000 insurgents waiting and prepared for the assault. But the bigger question may be, who wins what in the attack on Fallujah? Tonight on Point, the battle for Fallujah and Washington's insurgency challenge in Iraq. We begin tonight in Fallujah with Boston Globe correspondent Ann Bernard. She is embedded with the Army's 1st Infantry Division. I asked her what she saw from her vantage in today's assault on Fallujah.
Soldiers from the 1st Infantry Division entered the city through crossing a berm in tanks and Bradley armored fighting vehicles that sort of lumbered through the sand and entered the city. It was a little hard to navigate in the narrow streets of the city. They took some small arms fire and from suspected sniper positions, but there was not the heavy resistance that some people thought there might be. Now it's actually eerily quiet, very dark, and the only light we can see is from a mosque where we can hear the prayers going on.
What part of the city are you in now, Anne? Are you in the downtown or a dense commercial area or a suburban area? How deep into the city?
It's a dense residential area, I would say. We're in a building that the troops broke down the door to use as an observation post over a school and a mosque. We're trying to hold the area until some Iraqi soldiers can come in.
And has the group that you're with taken any casualties today?
Not that I know of, although we only have the sort of small end of the telescope view of the squad, of the infantry squad that we're with. So there have been casualties elsewhere.
And General Casey today said that he believes that 50 to 70% of Fallujah's residents have left the city. Have you seen evidence of civilians?
We haven't seen a single civilian. It's completely dark. The streets are completely empty. Now, a lot of my ride into town was in the back of a Bradley fighting vehicle so that I couldn't see anything, but I could listen to the radio traffic, and the commander of the vehicle also was not seeing any civilians.
And what about the bombardment that preceded the troops moving into the city, Anne? Can you describe it for us, the U.S. bombardment of Fallujah?
Well, it's been pretty spectacular, and it's been going on since early this morning. You'll see the white phosphorus rounds that look like huge white octopuses hanging in the sky. You can probably hear some shooting right now. I think that's tank fire. They're clearing a path for themselves as they advance through the city. They're also firing at buildings that they believe to be insurgent strongholds.
And we heard that gunfire. Are you in a fixed position now, or are you still in motion there?
Well, right now we are at a building that they've taken over to use as an observation post over an area that they're hoping to seize control of. So this building is under control, but obviously the situation is still pretty fluid.
Have the troops with you been taking incoming fire from insurgents there?
Well, actually, there wasn't as much resistance as they might have expected. There were a bunch of roadside bombs that went off that had been rigged in the area as we came in, and they tried to blow them up preemptively. There's been some small arms fire and some snipers, but no large groups of insurgents resisting the advance, and so far no catastrophic booby traps or anything like that. So that's actually the biggest question here, is whether this will be the showdown between insurgents and the U.S. and Iraqi forces that the Prime Minister had hoped it would be, and the U.S. commanders had hoped it would be, a chance to really wipe out the heart of the insurgency, or will they just run away and fade back into the population like a guerrilla force and sort of remain elusive? Some of the troops here were saying that they're actually not surprised that they didn't see a big fight tonight. In a city of 200,000, a force of even 3,000 to 5,000 insurgents is not a lot of people to cover that much ground. So maybe it's not surprising that in the one area of the city that we're in, we haven't seen a lot of people, but perhaps they'll make a stand somewhere else in the city, perhaps when a friend comes up.
And some commanders are talking about this takeover of Fallujah taking a matter of days. What about the troops you're with? How long do they think this will take?
I'm not sure how much I am supposed to say while it's still ongoing, but according to the plans, they had hoped that it would be relatively quick to get down to the to take control of the main points in the city, but we really just began. It's about 11 o'clock at night here, and the troops I'm with only entered the city sometime after 8. So I wouldn't write off the possibility that their sector will be completely under control by the morning, but they've really only just begun.
What's the mood among the U.S. troops you're with, Ann?
I mean, they're very sort of calm and to some extent relieved, to some extent disappointed that it hasn't been the big fight so far that they expected. But overall, they really just treat it like a job. And, you know, as we were sitting in the Bradley getting ready to go, everyone was getting stressed out and frustrated because we spent so many hours sitting around in the Bradley, and they just wanted to get out and, as they said, do what we came here for. It's just a very strange thing to be in a city at war. On this rooftop, there are strange glowing piles of residue from phosphorus rounds that have fallen. Obviously, we are very concerned about what may be the situation of civilians that have been hurt, but we haven't seen those people. We don't know how many of those reports have been exaggerated by insurgents. We also... It still remains to be seen how the American armored forces will fare in an urban environment against guerrillas. The tank driver on the list kept getting confused about which direction we were driving, and yet at the same time he could turn around and smash through a wall when we needed to. So it had its advantages and its disadvantages.
And where will you be sleeping tonight? Do you know, right there?
Oh, I don't think we'll be sleeping.
Well, we wish you good luck, and to all the people you're with there, and thank you very much for joining us, Ann.
Well, thank you.
Ann Bernard, a correspondent for the Boston Globe, embedded with the Army's 1st Infantry Division. She spoke with us from Fallujah in the midst, as you heard, of fairly steady gunfire. It has hardly been a secret. The U.S. High Command has telegraphed its intentions for weeks, saying a cleanup of insurgents in the Sunni Triangle city of Fallujah was crucial to the success of scheduled January elections in Iraq and to the long-term stability of the country. But will it work? This hour on Point, the battle for Fallujah and Washington's insurgency challenge in Iraq. You can join the conversation. Do you believe a victory in Fallujah by U.S.-led forces will turn the tide against insurgents inside Iraq? Can a successful military operation in Fallujah pave the way to stability in the Sunni Triangle? Does the United States have a winning counterinsurgency strategy in Iraq? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, is Stephen Metz, chairman of the Army War College's Strategic Studies Institute and the author of Insurgency and Counterinsurgency in Iraq. Good evening and welcome, Stephen Metz.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thanks very much for being with us. You've written co-authored a pretty major document about counterinsurgency strategy in this day and age and in this theater. We'll look at the big outlines of that, but first, just to Fallujah, Stephen Metz, what do you make of the way this confrontation is unfolding as we talk tonight?
Well, it has been very interesting the way it's set up, the idea of building force up more or less in public sight in order to, as you said, telegraph the intentions, which really in a lot of ways makes sense because one of the primary objectives in a counterinsurgency is to separate the insurgents from the people, and that's exactly what the coalition forces have been trying to do in this particular instance.
Some debate over the exact population of Fallujah these days. Some say 200,000. General Casey said 200,000 today. Others 300,000. He estimated that 50% to 75% of those civilian residents have left the city. Do you have any impression of how big a civilian population U.S. and Iraqi troops coming in are going to have to deal with as they try and sort out insurgents?
Well, it certainly sounds like a reasonable number to me. I mean, there were always people moving in and out at any given time, and it's clear from every indicator that a significant number of people have left in the past few weeks, which, of course, is very good news.
Can you tell about the role of the Iraqi troops and their effectiveness at this stage in the assault, Stephen Metz? We heard, of course, over the weekend, Iraqi units where hundreds just left. Even a very high-ranking Iraqi soldier just took off before the assault. Do you have any sense of what role they're playing now?
Well, I don't have any indication of the role that they're playing in the actual assault. It is clear that since the first battle of Fallujah last April, extensive efforts have been expended to improve the training, the morale, the leadership of the Iraqi forces. I think we need to remember that counterinsurgency is a very, very difficult business, and the Iraqi security forces still are a very, very young military. But my expectation, at least, is that that they'll perform markedly better than they did last spring.
And then there's this issue of how long this is likely to take. We heard a few days ago it could take months to, I guess, pacify is the word, Fallujah. Today we're hearing perhaps a few days from General Casey. Do you have a sense of time frame?
Well, I think it makes a lot more sense to think of the months-long phase, because the clearing is just the initial part of it. Anytime in a counterinsurgency, you have sort of the two parts where you have to clear an area, and then perhaps more importantly, you have to secure it, which takes a long-term presence, clearing, working with the people, rebuilding, and things like that. So while I think it would be reasonable to expect that the insurgents would be cleared from the city in a few days, it really will be 6 months, maybe 12 months, maybe 2 years down the road before we see ultimate success of the stabilization of the city.
Stephen Metz, Donald Rumsfeld was asked today whether the fighting in Fallujah would continue until there was a clear and final victory, unlike last spring, of course, where Marines withdrew in April when things got too bloody. Rumsfeld said, "I cannot imagine that it would stop without being completed." It wasn't exactly yes to clear and final victory, but something would be completed. Is this a completable mission, Stephen Metz?
Well, I think certainly the mission of clearing and stabilizing Fallujah is attainable, and it's also vital. I mean, this has been the epicenter of the insurgency from the beginning. It's been U.S. strategy from the beginning to provide the new Iraqi government that's selected in January with a stable environment. So, given the effort that we're making there, given the quality of our troops, I have full confidence that we will see it through and provide a stable region to the government that's elected in January.
But you heard Ann Bernard with the troops in Baghdad just now saying their concern is that the insurgents may just melt away and come back. And we've seen this now. We saw it in Samarra, where there was, of course, an offensive a few weeks ago, and then some fairly major attacks just in the last few days. How do you... The idea is to surround and trap and clean up, to use Alawi's word today, the insurgents. But can that really be done? What about the melting away factor with all that long telegraphing of U.S. intentions?
Well, I really think that was part of the thinking all along. A preferable situation would be to capture, to eradicate the insurgents. But the core of a counterinsurgency always is to separate the people and the insurgents. So if they melt away and the new Iraqi forces are able to establish security in Fallujah to set up a permanent presence, I think that it's very, very unlikely that the insurgents would be able to move back into the area.
They did it before, of course. They did it in April with what appeared to be relative ease.
Oh, absolutely, because Fallujah was never fully secured at that point. We weren't able to establish a security presence after it. I think that's what's really going to be one of the things that's going to be significantly different about this Fallujah operation versus the first one. The first one struck at the insurgents, but it didn't establish that long-term presence. And that's kind of one of the things that I think the American military and its coalition partners have learned from the lessons of Vietnam, because in Vietnam we would often do the same thing where we would do large-scale sweeps. We would clean out a region, but we didn't leave behind security forces to assure success. I think that American military leaders and Department of Defense officials have indicated that they're very serious about the long-term securing of Fallujah this time, and to not allow the reinfiltration. And you know,
Hold the thought there. We'll come back to it. We've got to take a short break. We're talking with Stephen Metz at the Army War College. There's much more to come. We are looking tonight at the battle for Fallujah. You can join this conversation. What do you see riding on the fighting tonight in Fallujah? Are you glued to the news of young U.S. Marines in those narrow streets? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the battle for Fallujah and Washington's insurgency challenge in Iraq. You can join the conversation this evening. Does this look like a decisive battle to you, one that could turn the tide in Iraq, or will the insurgents just show up somewhere else down the road? And there's this, is American military superiority enough to defeat the insurgency in Iraq? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined tonight by Stephen Metz, chairman of the Regional Planning and Strategy Department at the Army War College's Strategic Studies Institute, author of Insurgency and Counterinsurgency in Iraq. We're joined now as well from Washington by Colonel Thomas Hammes. He's senior Marine fellow at the National Institute for Strategic Studies, a highly decorated Marine Legion of Merit with two gold stars. He's author of The Sling and the Stone, War in the 21st Century. Colonel Hammes, thanks for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
So everybody, including Stephen Metz, along with us tonight, is watching Fallujah and thinking, first of all, about the immediate safety and success of those U.S. troops there, but then more broadly, about what this is really going to mean for this big, gangly, mutating insurgency in Iraq. Do you see this, Thomas Hammes, as a decisive battle?
I don't think there's any such thing as a decisive battle in an insurgency. By nature, they're political rather than military, and they're long-term. What will make this a big plus for the U.S. is, like Steve said, if we can govern after we have swept through, there's no question we can move through the city. The question is, can we bring in sufficient Iraqi security forces and civil servants, the people who run the water, the people who haul away the trash, the people who run medical and just the government? If they can come in behind us and establish a secure place for people to live and work, then it's a very big plus for us.
Now, the record of doing that successfully looks fairly catastrophically poor overall since the initial invasion of Iraq, at least by everyone who we have who we've talked with on this show. Do you see some indication, Colonel Hammes, that U.S. and Iraqi forces are in better shape to do that effectively in Fallujah than they've done nationally in Iraq?
Well, a couple of things have changed since we've had so much problems. First off, most of our problems were under Ambassador Bremer and General Sanchez. That leadership team never really came together. Now we've got Ambassador Negroponte and General Casey, who are a very close team, and President Alawi. And the three of them have agreed on an approach, and they're taking a classic counterinsurgent approach. For instance, they went into Samarra about 40 days ago. Everybody was then pushing immediately go to Fallujah and go on to Ramadi. And instead, they slowed down. It seems like they've gotten pretty good control of Samarra. There were some significant attacks there 2 days ago. The question I have that I haven't been able to get an answer from the open media is, after all those policemen were killed 2 days ago, did the police come back to work the following morning? If they did, it indicates a real determination and a great deal of courage on their part, and that's a huge plus. If they didn't, then we do have a problem with the ability to govern.
Stephen Metz, we're all watching from a long way off here, but we like you, have seen all these news reports of policemen lined up execution style and shot, of Iraqi forces walking away from police stations, of Iraqi troops just disappearing themselves. Are you confident, and this is putting aside the winning of the city, but are you confident that once won, U.S. and Iraqi troops are now in a position to really do the rebuilding and maintenance of security required to make it work?
I don't know if I would use the word confident, but I would say that I'm guardedly optimistic, because there have been good signs of growing determination on the part of the Iraqi security forces, certainly an intense effort in the last 6 to 10 months to increase their leadership, improve their leadership, improve their morale, increase their training. So at least from every indication I'm seeing, I really hope and expect for them to perform better than they did last spring.
And Stephen Metz, you and Colonel Hammes both have been writing about the importance of looking anew at insurgency, how insurgency itself globally is morphing in these recent years. Do you see the U.S. military operating on a strategy that's kept up with, I guess, what is that evolution you're seeing in insurgency, and is the U.S. military keeping up? Stephen Metz.
Do you want to take that one, Steve? You want me to?
Sure. Yeah, well, I'll go first.
Well, you both have a whack at it, but Stephen Metz, perhaps you first.
Well, I think that literally as we speak, the U.S. military is examining 21st century insurgency, trying to make an assessment as to what's changed from 20th century insurgency, and given that to decide how much of what we new and what we used in terms of doctrine, strategy, operational concepts, and things like that can be applied to the current form, and how much needs to be changed. Just to give you an example of a couple of what I think are the most important mutations or changes that are taking place in insurgency. One is that in 21st century insurgency, since there aren't outside patrons providing training, equipment, money, and things like that like there was in the 20th century, 21st century insurgencies much more have to rely on their own ability to raise funds, to buy arms, and things like that. What that means is we're seeing this kind of unholy marriage between insurgents and organized crime. We're already beginning to see that in Iraq, and I expect us to see it even more. Another important mutation that the U.S. military is reacting to and adapting to today is the highly decentralized, the word often is used, network organization of contemporary insurgencies. They're much less hierarchical, centrally organized than past ones. So these are really important changes that are requiring us to revise our doctrine and strategy, and that is underway today.
And Tom Hammonds, you, in your book, The Sling and the Stone, raised some pretty large concerns, and if I'm not incorrect, I think you've said that superpowers, that is the Soviet Union and the U.S., are at the moment zero for five countering major insurgencies in recent years. How do you see what's unfolding in Iraq? What are your concerns?
Well, I agree with Steve that we're finally beginning to adjust. It's just amazing that large parts of DOD are still focused on the high-tech enemy that we would desperately like to fight rather than the one we're actually fighting in various parts of the world. We're still spending billions on expensive weapons systems, and we are just beginning to look seriously at the changes. I think he was right on in how it's changed. It's become a network. It's a coalition of the willing. And don't think permanent network. Think a shifting network. Just like businesses come in and out of alliances now, as their alliances shift, same thing will happen here.
You're saying coalition of the willing on the insurgent side.
Yes, it is. And in some cases, a coalition of the eager. They really want to get at us. One of the things that worries me most is we're doing nothing about our manpower system. We have a manpower system firmly rooted in 1890. And for your listeners not familiar with the Pentagon, that's the correct date. It's not 1990, it's 1890. In the 1890s were the bureaucratic reforms that led to going from small-time manufacturing to large manufacturing, and Elijah Root adopted that same process for the U.S. military. And we essentially have not changed our manpower system in a major way since.
You talk about fourth-generation warfare, and you're quite critical of, I guess this is what you're referring to also, of the Pentagon hierarchical structure. You say it's just not set up to compete here. When you say that the superpowers are 0 for 5 in fighting insurgencies, what do you mean by that?
Well, an insurgent beat us in Vietnam. They drove us out of Lebanon. They drove us out of Somalia. They drove the Soviets out of Afghanistan and out of Chechnya. Now, the Russians are back in Chechnya, but they drove the Soviet Union out. And so we're 0-5 against them, and right now, if you still consider Russia a superpower and anybody with that many nukes is, they're not doing well in Chechnya. We're still in a toss-up in Iraq until we get serious about it, and we're doing well in Afghanistan. I'm not so sure how well we're doing on the global war on terrorism.
Stephen Mitz, that 0-5 record is not a heartening one. Do you see a corner being turned in Iraq, or are we being set up for another disappointment there?
Well, I guess I would look at that the record slightly different, because while I think that's certainly accurate of counterinsurgencies that the two superpowers took on in a direct way, one of the lessons the United States did derive from Vietnam is that we're much more successful when we play an indirect or supporting role. So I think, for example, you could look at the example of El Salvador in the 1980s, the support the United States has provided to the Philippine government over the past couple of years as examples of a slightly alternate model of counterinsurgency where there was a little more success. And that's one of the lessons that I really try to stress in my own writing, that when we, the United States, takes direct control and operation for a counterinsurgency, as we did in Vietnam after about 1965 or 1966, it's very difficult, maybe even impossible. Where we do best is when we help create an effective local government that really has this intense stake in the conflict, and we play the role of providing support, advice, training, financing, and things like that to them. And I really see that as the way we're moving in Iraq. Initially, for the first 6 months or so, out of necessity, it was one where the United States and its coalition partners like the U.K. were primarily responsible for the counterinsurgency effort. Now the direction we're moving is to stress that this is the new Iraqi government's war to win or lose, and our role is to support them rather than to undertake counterinsurgency ourselves.
Though as we speak tonight, it sure is U.S. forces in the spearhead of what's going on in Fallujah. We know there are big regional implications here, and we'll hear more about that as the conflict in Fallujah unfolds. We're getting a kind of a military perspective tonight. I'm joined by Stephen Metz and Colonel Thomas Hammes. I want to welcome into our conversation from Cambridge, Massachusetts, Marine Corps General, retired, Bernard Traynor. He's former Deputy Chief of Staff for Plans, Policies, and Operations. He's author of The General's War. Good evening and welcome, Bernard Traynor.
Hello, Tom.
Thanks, sir.
How's it going?
Very good.
You're getting salutes from our crew here tonight, General Traynor. Give us your sense of how Fallujah is going at this early point and your overall sense of the counterinsurgency effort of U.S. troops and Iraqi forces in Iraq.
Well, I don't imagine that they'll have any sort of problem taking Fallujah. After all, we have somewhere between 10 and 15,000 troops and enormous firepower. And the opposition, according to General Casey today, was around 3,000. That may be true. It may be less. Mm-hmm. If you look at the modus operandi of the opposition, they don't like confrontation. So what they do is they move in an indirect fashion with suicide bombs and IEDs and things of this nature. So I suspect that there's no reason, except for a few hardcore zealots, to really hang on to Fallujah. And these are the people. And I must say that even a small number of people can cause a lot of problems when you're in urban combat. But I think for the most part, the resistance movement, the insurgents, will kind of spread out and they'll set up someplace else. So at best, this is a psychological and political milestone on the way to representative government.
A necessary milestone on the way to that, in your view, even if it doesn't really begin to wipe up the nationwide insurgency?
It's a necessary one. Fallujah has become symbolic. It's become symbolic on both sides. And somebody has to control Fallujah, if only for the symbolism. So if we are to move towards the democratic elections that they are broadcasting for January, Fallujah has to come under government control. Even from a military standpoint, it's insignificant.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Jim is calling from Viroqua, Wisconsin. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Hello. Say, I was an Air Force officer during Vietnam, attended the U.S. Air Force Academy, and I really appreciate the comments that it's been very instructive here. But didn't we learn anything in Vietnam? We had superior firepower in Vietnam, and unless we were willing to occupy that country, there was no way we were going to win. We could control any city, okay, but you can't win the war. And I just keep thinking, and I try to talk to my kids about, think about the American Revolution, okay? Mm. What if we were on British radio during the American Revolution? I mean, the Americans were insurgents, okay? We had, the British had superior firepower.
We'd say they were riffraff hiding in the woods.
Right, right. And they'd move into New York and take over New York and all, and the Americans would move into the woods and come back out again. There, and you say we're 0 for 5, and we're going to be 0 for 6. You cannot win a war as a foreigner in another person's turf.
Okay, but I think that's the important point Steve made. We're not. We're training Iraqi forces to do that. You're right. We could not, the British could not rule America, but suppose there had been an American government. Suppose the British had said, hey, we really want to give you your independence, and we're going to go away, and these are the guys we're going to put in charge. We might well have been able to live with that. And while there's been a lot of disparaging comments about the Iraqi army, remember, the oldest unit in this army is 1 year old.
Mm-hmm.
The new units are 3 months old. Look at the record of U.S. forces in our first year in fights, other than in 90 and this last one. Usually, we start out very, very badly. All armies do, unless they have a rigorous training program and time. So I don't think they're doing too badly for units that are between 3 months and a year old.
Bernard Traynor, how do you see it? Jim was in Vietnam. He saw what he saw. He looks here, and he's afraid of where it's headed.
That's a very, very interesting commentary. And there's a lot of truth to it. I mean, no people want a foreigner to come in, even to help them. We become an antibody, and I think that's the case in all insurgency mm-hmm. situations. The key to an insurgency is a local solution on the part of the people, the indigenous people, coming in what is an effective political fight to get the support of the locals. Now, the outsiders can be a little bit of help, but they can also be a great hindrance. And as the case was in Vietnam, which was pointed out, you know, we won all the battles, mm-hmm. but we lost the war. Mm-hmm. Why? Because the government that we were supporting did not get the allegiance of the people. And that's the problem that we're facing in Iraq right now.
Jim, in Viroqua, this time it will be different, we're hearing, or could be. What do you think?
Well, I don't think that, history stands with us. I mean, I don't think that we are truly going to let the... at the Iraqis, I don't think we're open to letting Iraqis install an anti-American government there. But one more point, and then
yes.
I'm going to hang up,
mm-hmm.
if I could.
Mm-hmm.
Here, I think what we're doing, even though there are some positives, and I can't respect the troops over there more than I do.
Mm-hmm.
I know what they're going through.
Yep.
But what we're doing is we're actually harming ourselves. This is for political gain elsewhere. It's not for local gain there, because what we're doing, and you can see the Saudi...
The Saudi clerics who have said, you don't work with the Americans.
Okay, it's okay to resist now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what we're doing, and what we found in Vietnam, is that the more you bomb them, the more resistance you build into these people. And it's the same thing since the American Revolution. The more the British fought us, the harder we fought to win. And the local people are going to win, and it's maybe not the local people that we want to win or that we're backing, but they will win, and it's just a matter of how many young American boys, how many of my sons are going to die.
Jim, we've got it loud and clear. Thank you very much for your call. Stephen Mitz, you and all of our guests tonight are saying you've got to get it into local hands, but Jim's saying, well, which local hands are those going to be, and how can you be so sure that the local team of choice is going to be the one you're backing?
Well, I think his comments were very astute. One thing that I would add, if we're going to use Vietnam as the analogy, is there have been some criticisms over the past 6 or 8 months or whatever that what we're doing in Iraq is Vietnamization. Word kind of has a bad connotation to it. But if you go back and really look at the history, Vietnamization in some ways was actually successful. By about 1970, the United States and its Vietnamese allies actually had figured out a lot about counterinsurgency. We realized you had to do local security. We realized you had to break up the political infrastructure or whatever. The problem was it took us too long to learn that, and the political dynamics were against us at the time. And eventually, of course, it was a conventional assault, not the insurgency that overthrew the government of South Vietnam. I really think we have integrated and inculcated those lessons, and I think that we've recognized in Iraq that you have to start with that rather than ending with that.
Big challenges ahead on that road. Stephen Mitz, Colonel Hamas, General Trainer, please stand by. We have to take a short break. We're talking tonight about the battle for Fallujah and Washington's insurgency challenge in Iraq. You can join us. Is American military superiority enough to defeat the insurgency in Iraq? Can you see Iraqi forces stepping up to really do this work themselves? Anytime soon. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the battle for Fallujah, and it is underway. You can join our conversation. Can you see Iraqi forces stepping up to really do this work themselves sometime soon? And is the taking of Fallujah worth the images of destruction that will inevitably flash around the region, around the world? Is this the way to defeat the insurgency in Iraq? Do you have a better suggestion? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by a great team. Marine Corps General retired Bernard Traynor joins us tonight. He's former Deputy Chief of Staff for Plans, Policies, and Operations, author of The General's War. From Washington, Colonel Thomas Hamas. He is author of The Sling and the Stone, War in the 21st Century. And from the Army War College Strategic Studies Institute, Stephen Mitz is with us tonight. Right now, Jeff is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Good to have
Your
you.
Last question feeds directly into my point.
Good.
And that is that, and there will be another Vietnam analogy, which was that the story there was that we had to destroy the village to save it, and Lord knows we destroyed countless hundreds, if not thousands, of villages in Vietnam. And I have been pretty shocked at the sort of complacency of the reportage, first when the old town of Najaf was absolutely devastated, and a cemetery of great, of incredible sacredness to Shiites everywhere, of 1,300 years old, equally devastated. And it was just considered business as usual to use heavy American firepower in a dense urban setting.
Would everyone have been better off to let Muqtada al-Sadr's forces take over that city?
That's an arguable point, but I think that there should have been other ways of containment. Since he was rather than simply ruining this the place.
Well, then what do you do in Fallujah when it seems to have fairly clearly become a center for insurgency?
With all the reports in past months of the pinpoint bombing, 1,000-pound bombs put on putative safe houses, with all the stories about how great American Special Forces was, I always wondered why you didn't send special forces in to take out the people in those safe houses so that, one, they could be interrogated, and two, rather than endangering a whole neighborhood in the process.
Jeff, let us pick it up, and thanks very much for your call. General Bernard Traynor, how do you see it? We heard today an echo of this, the Vietnam haunting phrase from the Vietnam War, we had to destroy the village in order to save it. We heard today somebody in the Pentagon saying we have to surround Fallujah in order to protect it, clearly trying to offer an antidote view to that. But what about it? Is there a risk that U.S. forces, with all their power, their big bombs, will destroy Iraq in the effort to save it?
Oh, sure. There certainly is, Tom. And I think of the criticism. There is already criticism, including criticism from your just recent call of, but certainly within the Arab world. We are in a war out there, but I think everybody is focusing on the military aspect of it. But the real solution in all of these insurgencies and guerrilla wars is always a political solution, cutting a political deal which will allow some sort of stability and security to emerge. And I think that's what we're striving for. I think we've missed a lot of opportunities along these lines. But what you have going on in Iraq right now is not a fight against the outsider, although that's an element of it. Mm-hmm. But the bigger part of the fabric is that this is a power struggle as to who is going to control Iraq at the end of the day. And that's a political issue, not a military issue.
Stephen Metz, how do you interpret the political envelope around this? Is there a political solution here, given that the forces inside Iraq are riven, as General Traynor says? And what if some of those forces in Iraq actually prefer to see the United States kind of kept on the torture rack here?
Well, I think it's certainly true that there is the potential for political solutions with part of the Iraq insurgency movement. I mean, one thing that we constantly have to keep in mind is just how complex and diverse this insurgency is. There are parts of it that are organizations that are simply maneuvering for political power could possibly be negotiated with, perhaps even at the future when there is a fully independent Iraqi government, might even be brought into the government. There are other parts of the insurgent movement, like the outside jihadist, that simply can't be negotiated with. I mean, their demands are ultimate. They want ultimate power. They want to kill Americans. So I think it's very important for us to have this kind of sophisticated understanding and not talk about the insurgency as if it is a unitary whole, but to understand that it is a very complex coalition, a polyglot, a network, and we have to treat different parts differently.
Colonel Hammes, how do you see that? You made a kind of a sly joke earlier about the coalition of the willing, but saying that coalition is on the insurgent side, the anti-American or maybe anti-stability side. Do you see the combination of U.S. military power, U.S. political influence, and whatever's going on with the Iraqi political process, do you see something coalescing there that could actually be an antidote to the insurgency? Is it sufficient?
I think the key, and Steve brought this up, the new insurgencies are networks. The one in Afghanistan was not unified that drove out the Soviets, nor was the one in Chechnya, nor is the Palestinian movement. So you have to appeal to some elements of that and bring them on board into the government, and you have to understand which one of those can come aboard. And that's where the Iraqis have to take the lead. They understand the politics there obviously much better than we do, and they can decide what they can and cannot live with. And then it will be a long-term process of integrating this into some form of a country.
Ali's calling from Boston. Hi, Ali. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say that I think we're missing the larger picture, and we're getting our emotions involved in too much of, actually, not your panel, but the callers from Massachusetts.
What's your view, Ali?
Well, basically, look at it this way. If we weren't on the right path, the insurgency would also continue in Najaf and with the Shiites. We would have seen some sort of political instability as well as the military with the Turks and the Kurds. They've shown a lot of strain at holding back themselves and not pursuing their own ambitious greater Kurdistan. So we are on the right path, and this is just another step toward the right direction. And if we don't stay with it, then we're going to lose our credibility, and then the Shiite leaders that stayed with the U.S. government are going to lose their war, their faith, and some thug like Muqtada al-Sadr is going to show that, see what I was saying? We should continue fighting Americans. But if there was no force behind Muqtada al-Sadr, he would have never come down. He would have continued on pushing, and he wanted to have his own base and his own form of government. So I think we're doing the right thing. We're continuing on the right path, and we have to stay with it.
Ali, we've got it, and thanks very much for your call. Colonel Traynor, the right path, maybe, though it sure has not looked like what we were led to expect in Iraq. Do you agree that we're on the right path tonight?
Well, we're on the only path that's available to us at this point, Tom. I mean, the original plan was to go in to Iraq and depose Saddam Hussein and the Ba'athist regime and maintain the integrity of the political and economic infrastructure of Iraq and then get out of there. This administration certainly was opposed to nation building in the Kosovo form, so they wanted to get in there, do the job, get out, and let the Iraqis take care of things. However, circumstances overcame that desire, and we didn't have enough forces in there to provide the stability and security that was necessary to allow an infrastructure to emerge and take over the government. And the end result was that we found this insurgency on our hand, which grew as our inability to cope with it was observed by the Iraqis. But I must say, you know, it's not all of Iraq is in chaos. There's large portions of Iraq, the majority of Iraq, both in the south and in the north, that are relatively stable. And all of the Iraqis clearly are looking for stability and security to get on with their lives. But these insurgents are intimidating people, and they're feeding on the xenophobia of the nation and causing a great deal of trouble by what they're doing. So if we are to see any sort of bright horizon in Iraq, this insurgency has to be broken in the Sunni triangle.
General Bernard Traynor, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Katiki is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Katiki. You're on the air.
Hi, my name is Katiti, Tom.
Oh, I'm sorry. Welcome. Good to have you.
Well, my point is that there's no amount of firepower that can ever overcome the passion that people feel when they feel invaded and occupied. And if you can, it's like a blister that you push it here, but it goes over there. If you've ever had a blister under your hand, under your skin. So, yeah, you know, we can go over there. Unless we're willing to bomb them like we did in Hiroshima and finish it off, forget it. It'll never, ever
But, Katiti, we're hearing tonight that there are considerable portions of the Iraqi population who want stability, they want order, they want to get on with their lives. They don't necessarily want to just have, unending fighting here. Do you see Iraqi nationalism united against the American presence there?
Not necessarily united, but you see, it's those people who are making the trouble that will never stop and will never go away.
Well, we've certainly seen that in a lot of other circumstances, Katiti. Thanks for your call, Stephen Metz. You point to a similar potential problem in your recent piece on counterinsurgency. You say its dominant characteristics are protractedness and ambiguity. And those things are hard for the American democracy to take over time.
Oh, absolutely. And I think the caller was exactly right that firepower can't overcome passion. But what our strategy calls for us to do in Iraq is to reconfigure that passion. I think our leaders recognize that so long as it is seen as a liberation struggle to throw out outsiders, the United States, then ultimately it is a losing hand. What we've done is we've redirected it. We've built it into a struggle in which the passion is configured as a passion for stability and development versus a passion for whatever the insurgents offer, which, you know, we don't know exactly what that is, but it's certainly instability. So that's kind of the real crux to American success. If we're able to reconfigure the sort of the psychological framework, the passion in Iraq, to the point that it becomes a national insurgency between the forces of stability and development and the insurgents versus a fight against outsiders, then that'll be a successful path.
Let's get one more call. Anne's calling from Northborough, Massachusetts. Hi, Anne. You're on the air.
Hi. This all makes me extremely anxious. You asked at the top of the hour if I was hanging on every newsreel. Mm-hmm. I can't. I'm so sick at heart of what's happening to our young men and women over there and what we're doing to the Iraqi people. I don't see how there's any legitimacy when the people in Iraq don't even support the head of the country that we put in place. And I agree with your former caller that, you know, we are the invader. This was an unprovoked war that we started. We can't leave. We have a moral obligation not to leave these poor people.
Everybody's
alone.
Trying to get to an election. Do you think that will solve things?
It's not going to happen. I think if the clerics have said they want people to boycott, these people are extremely religious and they will boycott. We have made such a mess, and we have a moral obligation not to leave these people. These people had to survive Saddam Hussein. Now they have to survive us.
But staying right now means at the moment, fighting, and we're almost out of time, forgive me, but I want to go to Colonel Thomas Hamis. How do you see this working out? If that's the right word, imprisoned 3,000 insurgents in Fallujah, is that going to make a difference?
No, as we've said all along, it's not a military struggle. It is political. So the elections are important, and while some religious leaders, specifically Wahhabis in Saudi Arabia, have said don't vote, the Shias have said to vote. So, and the Shias are saying, well, if you don't vote, you're going to end up like the Christians in Lebanon. They're totally irrelevant now in Lebanon. And I think the Sunnis are beginning to understand this. So we can gain legitimacy through the election. That doesn't mean the war's over then, because, as Stephen said, the key dynamic of insurgency is it's protracted.
General Traynor, last word goes to you tonight. On the other side of this assault on Fallujah, what will you be looking for, assuming that it goes well and doesn't take too long? What are you looking for to as an indicator of greater success?
Well, Tom, the Fallujah is incidental to the whole thing. This is a political struggle which may be determined by military force. And if politics can't find a solution, then military force on one side or the other is going to be the tipping point for an ultimate political solution. Not a very good prospect.
If military force can't solve it?
Military force in the final analysis could be the arbiter of what should be a political decision. I mean, this is the sort of thinking that Mao Zedong and all the revolutionaries in the past have talked about, that politics grows out of the barrel of a gun.
Well, let's pray it gets onto that political path, but tonight it's fighting. General Bernard Traynor, thank you so much for being with us this evening.
Thank you.
Stephen Metz at the Army War College Strategic Studies Institute, terrific to have you. Thanks a lot for being on board.
My pleasure. Great points by the callers.
And Colonel Thomas Hamis, author of The Sling and the Stone, War in the 21st Century, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed the discussion.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.